Autumn would love to introduce you to Scale IP, the world's fastest growing IP commercialization software. Are you ready to transform your tech transfer office into a marketing powerhouse? Using proprietary IP transaction data, Scale IP helps you easily find high intent companies that partner or license with universities, gain technical fit insights, and launch personalized email campaigns with the right IP decision makers to save time, money, and effort. Don't let your innovations get lost in the shuffle. Right now, you can get a buy one, get one free offer when you sign up with promo code AutumnLove1 at www.scaleip.com. That's Autumn, love, the number one, at www.scaleip.com.
You're listening to Autumn on the Air, the weekly podcast that brings you conversations about the impact of research commercialization and the people who make it happen. Join us for interviews with patent and licensing professionals, innovators, entrepreneurs, and tech transfer leaders on the issues and trends that matter most. Keep listening for an inside track on the people, IP policies, and politics changing our world.
Welcome to Autumn on the Air, where we explore the cutting edge of innovation, intellectual property, and the people driving change in these fields. In today's episode, we examine the world of indigenous knowledge and intellectual property and the complexities faced by tech transfer offices in protecting such knowledge and IP. Our guest today is Graham Strong, a commercialization manager at Otago Innovation from Dunedin, New Zealand, who has a deep expertise in both intellectual property and indigenous rights. Graham's here to share his knowledge and insights on what tech transfer offices need to know when considering how to protect indigenous IP and how to engage with indigenous communities in a culturally respectful and meaningful way. Graham, it's fantastic to have you on the podcast today.
Thank you, Lisa. Look, it's really good to be here, and I certainly appreciate your taking the opportunity to chat with me today. It's a great privilege, and thank you very much.
Yeah, I'm excited about our chat today because you have a lot of expertise both in intellectual property and indigenous rights, and I thought maybe the best way to start this podcast was to ask you, what exactly is indigenous intellectual property, and how is it different from the Anglo-American IP system?
I think one of the interesting challenges in this space is trying to get an understanding around the difference between traditional knowledge and indigenous intellectual property and how that might be different. I think if you look at it from an international perspective, there are a number of different definitions of what traditional knowledge or intellectual property might be, and they tend to be relatively generic. I think if you really want to get a feel for what traditional knowledge or indigenous intellectual property might mean to the people or indigenous people where you are, then they will tell you. It sounds a little bit like a little bit of a cop-out, but in the same vein, there is no sort of singular worldview around traditional knowledge. So each individual community or even parts of that community will have a different understanding of what it may or may not mean to them. But I think from a general perspective, one way that you can look at the difference between, let's call it Anglo-American intellectual property, the thing we work in every day, and traditional intellectual properties to consider along these lines. And so imagine for a second that the Anglo-American intellectual property system is a game of chess, and I've made a massive assumption that people know at least this thing exists that's called chess, and all the different pieces that particular game might have. And then on the other hand, imagine that traditional knowledge is a game of checkers.
Very different.
Little wonder that Indigenous people might show up to a conversation around intellectual property and wonder why they lose. They lose because they're going to a chess game with checkers pieces. So if you understand that fundamental difference, you don't really need to get into the nuts and bolts of what it is. You just realize that one thing is very different from another thing.
Yeah, that's really a really neat way to describe it and explain it. And I wanted to follow up and then ask you, how can universities ensure that they're engaging Indigenous communities in a culturally respectful and meaningful way when using traditional knowledge?
I think it's a really good question. I think there's probably two parts to this. The first one is you have to be comfortable at being uncomfortable. Why is this space uncomfortable? It's uncomfortable because, one, people are involved, and often that leads to things being uncomfortable. But secondly, it's uncomfortable because technology transfer professionals, say, such as ourselves, are fearful of saying or doing something that will offend someone. And I can assure you that at some point you're going to say or do something that will offend someone. And Indigenous people, we're concerned that someone like a technology transfer professional will either be directly involved in or facilitate the theft of our stuff. And so that makes it quite a tense environment to be in right at the very beginning. But if everyone understands that being uncomfortable is okay, then the conversations can start. The other important part about why recognition and respect of Indigenous IP and research and innovation is important comes down to two words: reputational damage. So in today's social media hyper-connected world, it's actually easier for Indigenous people to express their views over misappropriation of their intellectual property. And reputational damage has become a very important thing for universities to consider when they're engaging with Indigenous people. So I would have that at the back of my mind. I think it's an important thing to take care of and be mindful of.
Absolutely. Yeah, in this day of social media, it doesn't take much to damage a reputation, that's for sure.
No. No. And it's very hard to come back from.
Yeah, exactly. Extremely difficult in this day and age. Once you're canceled, as they say. So
it's true.
Very, very true. So, Graham, given all your experience with IP and Indigenous rights, what would you say are some of the key challenges when protecting Indigenous IP in the context of tech transfer?
So I think one of the important things to bear in mind is that in my view, and others will disagree, is I think we overthink this a little bit too much. Do this sort of stuff at your desk. You actually have to get out there and talk to people, and you've got to recognize that Indigenous people have a different point of view, as I mentioned before, than what you or your organization might have. I think the other thing to bear in mind too is that the word traditional knowledge and traditional IP can be a little bit of an oxymoron, is that we should be well aware that invention didn't stop, 100, 200, 300 years ago, and that it's no different from anyone else in the world, that actually the inventiveness of people is an organic thing that's happening every day. So I think when it comes to engaging with Indigenous communities, you've actually got to get out there and demonstrate that that's something you're willing to do, and you can't do that at your desk.
So, Graham, tell us, how should universities handle things like consent and ownership when traditional knowledge is embedded in a new technology?
I think the interesting thing here is that one of the things that I'm very keen to do is try and bring the thinking from a checkers point of view into to a chess point of view, so that technology transfer professionals can move the dial in terms of feeling comfortable about the space. And the first thing to do is in my mind, is that if you treat Indigenous intellectual property as background IP, and background IP is something that we're all very comfortable with. We have our own background IP. The partners we work with have their own background IP, and everyone who brings background IP to the table expects that background IP to be treated in a specific way. And it's absolutely no different from Indigenous people, except for one thing, that often that background IP is in the public domain. And in terms of trying to protect it, that obviously makes it difficult. But on the way you handle that background IP and the consents and ownership around it can come to a couple of things. The first one is called prior informed consent. So do you have an agreement in place with the traditional owners of this intellectual property that will allow you to commercialize it? And then the second thing is called mutually agreed terms, which is, do you have an understanding between yourself and the traditional owners of that information on what the outcomes of the technology and how that might be shared? And the way you wrap that up is called an access and benefit share agreement. Now, you can go to the World Intellectual Property Office. You'll see copies of access and benefit share agreements around there. Do people do this often? Not really, simply because it's new for a lot of people. But essentially, those are the sort of types of agreements that you can have in place to be able to handle the consent and ownership. The one thing I would say is that ideally these conversations should happen before any research or commercialization program starts. So I think we would agree that technology transfer offices tend to be at the end of the research pathway, whereas actually it should happen at the very beginning before academics and researchers start their work. So it might not be the TTO that has these agreements in place. It could be your research office or division or equivalent that should be doing this sort of stuff. The last thing you need is a TTO who's going to commercialize intellectual property to discover that actually they don't have any rights around the intellectual property that's been put into a new program. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that does make a lot of sense. I'm curious because I suspect there aren't a lot of tech transfer offices that are familiar with those agreements. You know, how did your institution get started in terms of drafting those types of agreements?
Look, it's still a work in progress for us. That's a really interesting way to say that it doesn't happen very often. And what we do in the first instance is that instead of putting in these agreements in place, what we've done in the first instance is put memorandum of understandings in place. So our organization as a broader, as a whole, the university as a whole has a memorandum of understanding with our Indigenous communities, and that provides some platform. And then we as a TTO, Otago Innovation as a TTO, also put agreements in place with commercial partners. So that's the first step. And then from there, as the technology develops, if it looks like it's going to be commercial, that MOU sets up almost like a term sheet, the types of things that would go into to a access and benefit share agreement.
That makes a lot of sense to me because I'm thinking if you try to negotiate an agreement at the outset, it probably would take a very long time and hold the research and everything else up. So I think that sounds like a very practical way of dealing with that situation.
No, you're right. It's a delicate balance because it's the amount of trying to incorporate a number of resources at the very start and what the outcomes of the use of those resources might be.
Absolutely. So then that leads me to ask you about the role that Indigenous communities play in the decision-making about how their knowledge is used and shared. How exactly does that work?
Yeah, so I would argue no different for any other partner that you work with. So as I said before, when someone comes to the table with background intellectual property, there's expectations on how that might or might not be used. And so as a TTO, when you're looking at that sort of information, you have to make a decision as to whether this is something that you as an organization are able to accommodate or not. Now, I think it's important to say that you don't actually have to do anything. You know, there's no obligation on anyone to do a deal with someone around traditional knowledge, but there is an obligation to be able to treat that fair and reasonably. I think it's important when you're drafting these agreements to understand that many Indigenous communities don't necessarily have the resources available to them to be able to be, let's call it, a transactional partner. And so often when you're pulling these things together, it's important to put in not only financial outcomes, but non-financial outcomes. So if the universities, for example, are looking to build long-term partnerships with Indigenous communities, then often it's the non-financial things that actually carry more weight at the outset. One is because they're usually easier for the university to deliver. Think about things like educational programs, sharing of publicly known information. Like, for example, we have a dense school, so our dental academics can talk to communities about oral care. All that sort of stuff is actually quite important. Or the university might offer scholarships, for example, that helps Indigenous entrepreneurs move forward. There's a number of things that are non-financial that doesn't necessarily cost your organization a lot, but has an incredible amount of high value for the Indigenous community. So it's a balance of those two, financial and non-financial, when you're pulling these partnerships together to take into account.
That's really interesting and very fascinating. And I would imagine that's one way that universities can help build some long-term partnerships with Indigenous communities rather than, like you said, just seeking these transactional agreements. Are there some others you can share with us?
So, for example, if you think about it from this perspective, and realizing that there's all sorts of different points of view involved. If you go, what are the things that universities in particular academics are most comfortable with? Well, they're most comfortable with sharing stuff because they're in universities, they want to create public good, all that sort of stuff. Often they overshare, we know that. But I mean, at the same time, this makes it a little bit easier. I think when we, as TTOs, our aim is always to try and sell or license our technology. So we tend to go in with a transactional mindset. I think we have to bear in mind that Indigenous communities are very intergenerational. It's intergenerational well-being, intergenerational wealth. So you have to go in with the mindset initially anyway that there might not be any, let's call it financial transactional stuff happening soon.
That makes a lot of sense. Is there ever a possibility that focusing too much on Indigenous IP, I mean, it sounds like sometimes this can really take a long time, that it might slow down innovation or hinder tech transfer in universities?
That's a fair question. And the answer is that's very possible because often there is not necessarily one Indigenous group that might be involved, which goes back to my point that I made earlier on. You've got a really very clear understanding exactly who's actually involved in the particular project that you might have and who has a specific interest. So, for example, in New Zealand, most people will be familiar with Mānuka honey. Well, the Mānuka plant from which the honey is derived is all over the country. And so some people ask, well, I've got a new technology that uses Mānuka honey or Mānuka oil. Who do I talk to? And the response that we give them is whomever is in the area where you source the material from. So if you have sourced material from one part of the country, then that's the group that you should initially engage with. And they will be able to inform you as to whether there are other people that have specific interest. This is an important point because there's been plenty of examples where pharmaceutical companies have commercialized Indigenous intellectual property, have engaged with Indigenous communities only to find out that they weren't the only one that had a cultural connection with the particular biological material that was used and had to go back to the table, so to speak, and engage with them. So you have to have a bit of a clear understanding. Does it take longer? Of course it does. But that's the nature of the beast, unfortunately. And you have to decide for yourself whether that's worth the investment or not.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think kind of along those same lines, I'm curious whether you think universities should prioritize Indigenous knowledge protection in the event that it conflicts with global standards of IP and commercialization.
Well, it's a very good point. I think the first thing to say is that global standards of IP and protection also include Indigenous IP. So not only the things that we're familiar with around patents and trademarks, et cetera, but there are also international agreements in play with regard to protection of Indigenous intellectual property. So in some respects, that they're not mutually exclusive. I think the devil is in the detail, and there needs to be an understanding around how that might impact on your organization. So for example, if there's an international agreement around Indigenous intellectual property in which, say, that international agreement has been ratified by your country, then you need to see whether there's been any national legal legislation that has now accounted for that. Does that national legislation float down to the state level? Does that float down to your organization? And does that float down to your IP policy? And then is the infrastructure in play to be able to deliver on that? And I'm not aware of anyone who's done that well. So there's a string of things that you need to be aware of. And I guess surrounding all of that is that TTOs, as far as I'm aware, and some may be different, aren't exactly in a position to compel academics to do this sort of stuff anyway.
Exactly.
So there's a whole lot of, you know, let's call them legal and extra legal barriers that you need to get through to make this stuff happen.
Yeah, absolutely. It's kind of like trying to sort your way through the Nagoya Protocol. Sometimes exactly. If you have a biological, it can be incredibly complex. So
Very, very complex.
So, Graham, I want to turn next and ask you about the idea of cultural respect. Do you think at times that might be too vague or subjective to implement effectively in tech transfer?
I think the interesting thing is that it probably harks back to the point I made before, is that people are concerned about cultural respect, especially technology transfer professionals, as to whether they're overstepping the boundaries in some form or another. And you have to, there is a simple way around this in my mind anyway, and that is to really have strong conversations with your potential Indigenous partners with the expectations on how they might expect their knowledge and intellectual property to be used. In our experience, in some cases, some partners don't want any formal intellectual property captured at all. And by formal, I mean patents or trademarks or anything along those lines. In other cases, they're very happy to have patents put in place for potential inventions and technologies that might have commercialization outcomes. So unfortunately, there's no one single aspect that sort of fits everyone. And it really does come down to the individualization. Now, in those instances, to be fair, where we've talked to partners who are working with our academics who have said, we don't want any intellectual property captured at all. And our response is, well, for the most part, we have to capture intellectual property. And then we've decided, both of us, not to progress collectively together. And that's okay. I think the important thing is just to tell the truth and saying, unfortunately, that doesn't fit within our frameworks and there's not much we can do about it. It's very, very important to be straight with everyone, because that'll be a key part to creating trust and confidence between partners.
Absolutely. And you know, Graham, it's obvious from the conversation we've had so far that you've got a lot of experience kind of navigating the complexity of Indigenous IP. And I'm curious what your thoughts are, whether or not you think it's realistic to expect universities to be able to navigate these complexities while maintaining their core focus on research and innovation.
The answer is, yes, it is complex. I think the way it can work and work best is that it is weaved into the research system and is a natural part of the research system. Now, it's easy for me to say that. I think we both know that that's an incredibly complex and difficult thing to do. It's complex and difficult because it requires additional resources and it requires people who understand Indigenous space well. It requires, you know, bodies on the ground, and it requires changes in infrastructure. Ideally, as I said before, academics should be having discussions with Indigenous partners well and truly before they put in research programs. That, for the most part, doesn't happen. If it doesn't happen, then it comes across as a little bit disingenuous. And the key question, is it worth it to be able to do this sort of stuff? And my frank answer to that is only time will tell.
Yeah, absolutely. So, Graham, you mentioned a little bit before about benefit sharing, and I wanted to ask you, in cases where Indigenous knowledge is part of a new technology, do you think that the university's contribution to development should outweigh concerns over benefit sharing?
So I think it's a very good question, because for the most part, the question is derived from the fact that universities are probably inputting more resources into the development of a technology, either through their own internal resources or grant funding, than, say, the traditional partner might be. And it's something that we hear often about. And I think what I can say from this is that, one, by having an MOU set up at the very beginning about how intellectual property or Indigenous intellectual property should be treated between partners will go a long way to characterising how benefit sharing should or should not be implemented. I mean, traditionally, or the fallback position often is, if you put in 80% and I put in 20, therefore I get 80% of the benefit and you get 20% of the benefit, as a sort of generalisation. But this is a negotiation just like any other partner. I'm trying to get to a point where people understand that actually there's no need to really overthink this process. Just treat Indigenous partner as any other partner. Realise there might be a few quirks involved in that, and have a negotiation and see where it lands. I don't think there's an expectation on universities to overburden themselves with investment for the sake of Indigenous IP. I think you've got to have a hard discussion about that. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense, especially given the complexities involved that you've talked about already. And, you know, speaking of complexities, you know, navigating the consent and ownership of Indigenous knowledge, often when there's internal disputes within the communities about who owns that knowledge, is another issue. So how do universities navigate that when that's the situation?
It's a very good question, because there is a history of internal disputes amongst Indigenous communities, and that history is long, and it's long before, if I can use this language, colonization occurred. And so to expect some of those things to sort of be settled overnight is probably a little bit unrealistic, to be fair. So it's a fair point, and it's something that universities would have to get a handle around. And will it delay things? Of course, it's likely to delay things, simply because groups are trying to sort out how the intellectual property or the benefits of it are shared. But in my experience, and others may disagree, is that things start to get a little bit muddy and a little bit sticky when money shows up.
Definitely.
So the key thing is not to wait until money shows up. It's actually to deal with it very earlier on, and try and engage with the number of communities that you can. Like, if I was a university in the United States, for example, and there's a number of Indigenous communities around, I wouldn't just be engaging with one. I'd be engaging with the number that are likely to have a relationship with the area that I'm in, and see whether I can establish memorandums of understanding with all of those groups.
Have you been able to do that in New Zealand? And was it something that took a lot of time to do, or was it kind of a gradual process?
Well, from the University of Otago's perspective, I mean, there are, and I probably got this wrong, but there's probably about 64, 65 different iwi, or what we call tribes, in New Zealand. The South Island, for the most part, has one. So we're based in the South Island. So there are, in the northern part of the island, there are several others. But the university has memorandums of understanding with only a small number, I think, from memory, three or four. So, and because this central tribe called Naita, who is the main one where we're situated, that's the most important one in my mind, as far as commercialization is concerned. But when you break that down, that tribe is broken up into sub-tribes, which are called hapu, and then it's broken up into further into groups, which are called runaka. And those groups, there are three, which are very specific to our university, and we all have understandings with all of them. So it's important to go out there and find out who they are, and talk to them, and try and start the process of building trust in a way that actually, if something does happen in the future, everyone understands what's going to happen.
Absolutely. And I mean, it seems like you must have spent a lot of time with these tribes to figure out that there, you know, are sub-tribes and how they're all broken out, because it, like, we've been talking about complexity this whole podcast, but complexity in terms of even just organization of the tribes and hierarchy.
Yeah. It helps being part of one. I can say that with confidence.
I'm sure it does. Yes.
But in saying that, I think if for universities who are really, really keen on this space, you really do need to get an Indigenous representative on your team somewhere, or find them within your staff or people who are teaching in this space. Try and get an understanding on how, or if they're keen to work with you on technologies in the future.
Yeah, I would imagine that is a really key point for tech transfer offices, is to get an involvement from someone from that community. And I'm curious, Grandma, based on your experience, have you ever run into a situation where too much involvement of Indigenous communities in the decision-making process actually slowed down the commercialization of a particular technology?
We're involved in one right now. I can't go into the details, but the technology we're involved right now does require us to engage with an Indigenous community offshore, and it's not one that we're overtly familiar with. And so we're having to lean on colleagues in that location. Their rules and regulations are very prescribed, so we will have to get our heads around that and understand it. And then we'll have to engage with that community, and we'll probably have to travel and sit down around a table and drink coffee and talk about stuff to get a feeling for how they feel about this sort of commercialization process we want to be in. And then we'll have to get to a point at some point discussing access and benefit share. But this could take months, if not a year or more. It's a long time, because these people, they'll initially look at it, then they'll go back and talk to their own communities about it. Then they'll get a feel for whether it's something that they want to be involved in. Now, I can't speak for every traditional or indigenous population around the world, but if I can highlight a little bit like this, if you go in the traditional corporate system we're used to, you have it's triangle shape, right? So you have a CEO, then you'll have a series of managers, then you have workers and all the rest of it, and then the benefits flow down that way. But in the traditional world, especially here in New Zealand, it's the other way around. So you have all the people at the top, and then you progressively go down, and then you might have a corporate office that's responsible for some of the financial management of the tribe itself. And it's they're serving the people, not the other way around. Yeah, so then you have to understand how that machine works. And this goes back to my earlier point about chess and checkers.
Yes, definitely. That's such a great analogy with the chess and the checkers. I know you keep coming back to it. So, Graham, I wanted to ask you, you've had long-term partnerships with Indigenous communities. Have they always been beneficial, or have you found situations where they've limited flexibility in developing and commercializing technology there at the university?
This answer will sound like a little bit of a cop-out, but it varies. So the one that I mentioned before about where the Indigenous partner didn't want an intellectual property capture at all, that pretty much stifled that technology. No matter how commercially strong it might have been, there was no way that we could be a partner with them because they weren't interested in capturing any intellectual property at all. There's been situations where academics have come to us with a technology that's based on a native plant or other native biologic that looks really strong. We've approached the local Indigenous community, and the pushback has been really strong. I mean, in some instances, there's been some legal protection around it, but in other instances, not so much. But the feedback has been, if you commercialize this, then you're in for the fight of your life. And that's where the reputational damage comes into play. I think the other thing is that there needs to be an understanding at the academic sort of slash researcher level. And the reason is that if there are any sorts of formal agreements in place, so in New Zealand, we have an agreement called the Treaty of Waitangi, which was signed between in 1840 between the British Crown and Māori. And that treaty gives a certain number of rights to Māori people. Now, it's a highly contentious process. It has been going on for a long time and a lot of grievances, et cetera. And putting that aside, often academics in their funding applications say they would abide by the principles of this treaty without understanding what abide means. And it actually means, are they prepared to give control and veto rights over their research to the Indigenous community? And when they suddenly realize that's the case, they sort of get a little bit, I didn't know that's what it means. Well, that's what it means. So you've got to be really careful and sort of in it to understand what some of these things are.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that could be a big mistake by a researcher for sure. Yeah, surprise later for sure. So Graham, as we wrap up the podcast, I wanted to ask you, do best practices in Indigenous IP protection from other countries necessarily apply to universities in various legal, cultural, or economic contexts?
It's a really good question, and I'll frame it this way. In short, the answer is yes, and the question is how. So there's a number of legal and extra legal obligations, and I mentioned before you need to be mindful of some of the broader international and national legal requirements that you may or may not have around Indigenous intellectual property rights. So, for example, as I said, whether there's an implication from a national level then to a sort of international to national to state to the university's intellectual property policy, how does that impact on a TTO trying to deliver commercialization outcomes? But often that's the part that most people focus on. The bit that they don't focus on is what is the obligations on some of their research collaborators. So if an academic has a research collaborator in another part of the world which has signed these agreements, or there are commercial partners like pharmaceutical companies which are based in countries where these agreements are signed, then your academics might have to be mindful about researching or undertaking commercialization activity on Indigenous intellectual property where their research partners actually have an obligation to disclose and treat that Indigenous intellectual property in a certain way. And I think that's the bit that's often missed. Now, we had, in some instances, become aware of, and it hasn't happened to us, but where pharmaceutical companies are making sure that access and benefit share agreements are in place when they're looking or reviewing technologies that might be formulated in some part from Indigenous intellectual property or native biologics or something along those lines. So, yes, the implications are there. You need to be not only mindful of what your country's obligations might be, but also any collaborators that your researchers are working with and their obligations might be. And there's every chance they don't know either.
Yeah, it goes back to what we've been saying this whole podcast about the complexities in this area. It really is complex. And Graham, thank you very much for your time today. I'm sure if listeners have questions, you'd be happy to answer them, have them reach out to you. But really appreciate all your time today.
Thank you very much. And really appreciate you guys asking me to chat. It's been very good. Thank you very much.
Graham, thank you for sharing your insights on Indigenous intellectual property and traditional knowledge with us today. It is obvious that there is still a lot of work that needs to be done to help Indigenous communities protect their IP while doing so in a culturally respectful and meaningful way. To our listeners, thanks for tuning in, and we'll see you next time on Autumn on the Air.
Thanks for listening to Autumn on the Air with Lisa Mueller. Get social with us and share your thoughts. You can tweet us at AUTM or visit us online at AUTM.net. We'll be back next week on the air. Be sure to join us.